start and event. And first of all, I just wanted to welcome you all. Thank you all for coming. It's incredible to see such a full house. We never really quite imagined what a response we'd get to putting on such this kind of event, and it shows how important, how interesting, how thought-provoking what is going on in Chile is today, and how important history might be in helping us to unravel some of what's happening. I wanted to just say a few words before we turn to the film showing and then the discussion afterwards, and I think I wanted to start by saying some thank yous. I should say a big thank you to the America's Research Cluster in the Department of International History, which is sponsoring this event, and to its the leader of the cluster, which is Anna Kant, Dr. Anna Kant, who's here today as well. So thank you for supporting the event. A huge, enormous thanks goes to Alice Bryant, who is over there, who is our events coordinator, who's done an incredible amount of work getting ready for today's event. But perhaps the biggest thanks goes to Gloria Michaelis, who's sitting here, without who the event wouldn't have happened. She is not only one of the directors of the film that you're going to see tonight, along with Carmen Luz, but she is also, with her, we had the idea for the event, and she's been incredibly helpful in getting this event happening. Now, me and Gloria have been talking about the possibility of showing Crafting the Resistance at the LSE for a while. I teach a course, it seems very relevant to the course I teach, but then suddenly October happened and November happened, and it seemed even more timely, even more urgent, and even more important that we organise a showing, but not only to organise a showing and talk about the past, but to think about some of the parallels and to recover the memory of the resistance during the Chilean dictatorship in relation to what's happening today in Chile as well. I think with an audience like this, I don't really need to explain anything or to comment on much of what's happening in Chile today. I'm sure that most of you are familiar. I think some of you may be less familiar. I see some kind of students who might not have immediate contact with the Chilean situation. So let me just very briefly say a few words. Obviously, since October, widespread protests have broken out in Chile. What many or some people are calling a popular insurrection, actually. That's been a way to describe it. More than 1.2 million have taken to the streets or have held, many around the country have held cabildos or town hall meetings to discuss kind of where the country might be going. As many people know also, the government's response has been incredibly cruel, incredibly violent, and has contained repression and documented human rights abuses. Hundreds of Chileans have lost their sight in one eye, some two. And at this moment, we're not quite sure what direction the insurrection or the protests are going in. So that is something that I hope very much we can get to in the question and answer, maybe some suggestions of where things are going. At the moment, there looks like there will be a constitutional referendum or a referendum on whether to amend the constitution in Chile that's going to take place on the 26th of April. But the proposed timetable for what is going to happen in Chile seems like a very long and slow process, and the question is what might happen in between. So to discuss the past, as a historian, we will start with the past. So to discuss the past and potentially parallels or ideas about what the past can help teach us about the present, we are incredibly fortunate and honoured to have four Chileans here today who were involved in fighting against the dictatorship, who experienced time as political prisoners of the Pinochet dictatorship, and who have been very active in solidarity and resistance organisations from exile in the UK. So I will introduce them when they've sat up here at the front. I think it's probably easier rather than pointing to people in the audience. Just a couple of housekeeping rules before I move on to showing the documentary. And the documentary is about 25 minutes, then we'll have about half an hour, 40 minutes of discussion with the panel, and then we'll open up to Q&A. Just a couple of a brief housekeeping rules. Please can you turn your mobile phones to silent if you haven't already done so. And I also wanted to say that this event is being recorded because we'd like to actually release it as a podcast for the people who weren't able to attend. So I just wanted to say that when it comes to Q&A, if you don't
felt it was an important enough event that we wanted to record it for
others to be able to have the opportunity to hear it. So I think now we'll turn to the documentary. This is Crafting the Resistance, directed by Gloria Michaelis, Carmen Luce, and produced by Jasmine Gideon.
The message is that one shouldn't give up, even in bad circumstances. You can produce nice things, beautiful things.
Considering the situation, they were these people, they have the boot on top of them, they were able to be creative, they were trying to be creative, keeping their dignity.
Without this writing, I would have committed suicide, I think.
When you have those little gifts that you make out of a little button or something out of a nut or something, and you carve it and do something for a friend, it's showing your brotherhood or sisterhood.
My name is Sarah DeWitt. I am 66 years of age, and I was born originally in Chile, and I came to the United Kingdom in 1976 December. I was detained by the secret police during the dictatorship of Pinochet in Chile. I was finishing my social work training, and I was detained in April 1975.
I came here as a refugee in 1976, and after being in prison for 13 months in Chile, I was one of the lucky people who survived the Pinochet dictatorship, and also who arrived in England at a time when refugees were welcome.
Yeah, I came with my eldest daughter, who was only, when I was taken prisoner, she was 2 months old. When I left, she was just over two, when I was freed by the government without charge.
One day I was detained, and I was interrogated, I was tortured. They wanted to know information about my students, because at that time I used to teach at the university. I was a tutor.
I was a supporter of Allende, and of course I was a member of the political party in Chile, which is called the MIR. I joined the resistance, so we decided, we were young, 1973 I was only 21 years old. Most of the people who were organized in that network were also arrested, and were more than arrested, were kidnapped.
The reason why I came to the UK, although I didn't want to come here, was because I was taken into prison in Chile in September 1974, and the only way that I could be out of prison if I leave the country.
When President Allende was elected, I supported his election. I wanted some changes in my country. After the coup in 11 September 1973, I managed to survive until the 3rd of January 1975 on the underground, when I was arrested. We were detained under something called a stage of siege. We didn't have trials. We were never accused of anything. So you just didn't know what you didn't know, whether you could be taken, and some people were taken back into Villa Grimaldi to be tortured again, whether you could still disappear. You just never knew what was going to happen.
I was a member of opposition to the dictatorship. I took the decision to fight for the reestablishment of democracy. In total, I was 44 days in the center of detention and torture.
I was lucky in a way that that they didn't have much of my story when they caught me and put me in prison. I was taken and was very badly tortured with electricity and blows and all that.
The Venda Sexis, which were the two places where really people were subjected to torture most of the time, were certainly very obscure places and horrible places to be. But certainly in La Venda Sexy, where I was for about 2 weeks, was the whole issue of using sexual torture with women.
Physically, there was overcrowding. Some prisoners were not necessarily doing very well emotionally, so it was also that was something, a worry, you know, when one of our comrades was looking depressed or feeling unwell, so we all tried to help each other to pull through.
Although in the day we were all subjected to torture, really. In the evenings, these people were going home as if there was an office day, and we would spend those hours playing games, telling each other stories, making up stories.
Tres Álamos was the place, it was a place in Santiago where the people, the political prisoners that have been acknowledged as such were there, because quite a number of political prisoners were killed and disappeared before reaching that place. That was a place of sort of refuge for me. When I arrived there, I had passed through the different centers of torture. So I went there and I met a number of women. And that was the place where I remained for the next 2 years with many, many other women. I think that probably at some time we were nearly 300. We were trying to look strong, you know, especially against the people who, the police, who were monitoring our place of detention. We were continually harassed, and that, you know, was easy to undermine people.
I remember a lot of things about it. You will never forget your experience. You know, if you are in those concentration camps, you will never forget. Yeah. When I arrived there, they put us in a cell, which probably was 1 meter, you know, and in that direction, 1 meter wide, and 1.5 meter long. Yeah. That's all, and about 2 meters high. That's the place. And 4 people in that place, right? So that was the closets, you know. It was really a closet there.
The building was a really old building. At that time, it was in process of to be demolished. So half of the prison was almost, you know, rubble. So there were only some cells. We were put inside about 8-10 people sometimes, with no bed, just some mattress and blankets, that's all.
It was an awful place where they sent us in this Santiago prison, women prisoners. The mattresses were absolutely rotten with urine, impossible. So the first decision we made was to burn all these rotten mattresses.
Obviously, it wasn't the best, you know, very good condition. And food-wise was also, we had a lot of problems with, like, teeth, for example, because we weren't being fed properly. We will have just tea or, you know, a big thing of tea and hot milk in the morning with some bread.
The food wasn't very good. It lacked all sort of nutrient. And what we have, when our relatives were coming to see us, they were bringing us some food. And we centralized the food. Everybody was getting a ration, but for example, there were some women who were pregnant. We have someone with leukemia. Some people have other, you know, conditions. So for example, those women who were pregnant, we were tending to give them the eggs. We didn't have many eggs, but they would have some eggs.
There were wonderful leaders. They are natural leaders. And women are very, 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 very good for organizing themselves. In a few days, we had everything organized, how to clean the place, to keep it clean, to maintain it clean. And people were very good at following this. We organized classes, we study languages, because some of us knew that we have to leave the country. So there were English classes, French classes, German classes, and history classes, and other things, even mathematics.
We had what we call a taller laboral, like a workshop where we used to make from shoes to dresses, variety of things, and then we could also sell to some of the relatives that would go and use that money to buy basic things that we needed for many of our compañeras whose families were not able to visit them, or who were from outside Santiago that they couldn't really go every week.
That was extraordinary. You know, because to begin with, we're just doing it just to send, to keep ourselves occupied, to send something outside and learn new skills while we were in prison.
It wasn't facilitated in the way that they were giving us tools or anything. We were just doing it. And it was facilitated in the sense that they were allowing us to take the merchandise once the product were finished. Yeah, they were us allowing to do that. But with quite a lot of harassment to the people that were coming to get them. They were people mainly from human rights organization, La Vicaria, and so on. And we were passing them the merchandise.
I made a cardigan with what we call lana virgen, like wild wool. I haven't ever been able to do any knitting in my life before. I had to take lots of lessons from people who knew what they were doing, and it's a complete cardigan with a zip, and it's like a hoodie really, you know, something like that. Obviously it's over 40 years old, the zip bit is rusty. I don't know, I just kept it for sentimental reasons. It even got some few holes by now. I haven't worn it for years and years, but it was something that I was very proud of.
The basic unit where everybody do things, yeah, particularly in regard to the craft, what La Carreta, you know. Because at that place you met with a carpenter which is being arrested, or you met with a doctor which is being arrested, or you met with a student. So it was a mixture of everybody there, right? And everybody had different skill. From the very beginning in Tres Alamo, people were already asking their relatives to bring wool, to build looms, small looms, very small loom, or to build, to bring coins, which were, very easy to mold and to do, different type of craft. You had to take all the coin, and make it flat, right, and then engrave. Yeah. And we used very simple tools to do that. Yeah. So small files. You cut it in, you just break the file, and because these files are steel, so you use the file, to do the engraving. So you can do, beautiful figures on the coin, and you put it on the cigarettes.
The camp is full of noises when people are working. There are people working with metals, with silver coin, flattening them to make rings, to make medallions.
Sometimes during lunch, if you were lucky, we got some meat. The most part of this meat was bones. So we used that to make objects like hammers, doves, star. With a kind of knife, we carved the bone very carefully. We got a lot of time, so we weren't worried about the time, so just doing that whole day almost.
When I got hold of the stone, I did a lot of work in the kind of jewelry for my sisters, and for my mother I make some figures in copper. The good thing of concentrating in something that you want to achieve, and you are putting the mechanical sort of effort in doing something, it helps you to forget the situation that you are in. One problem is that there is a constant psychological pressure that you put yourself, because you start elaborating situation of what's going to happen with you, what's going to happen with. But when you are concentrated in doing something with details and time consuming and all this stuff, you concentrate so much that you alleviate your mind, and then you feel after that you have sort of have a break from that.
I was an embroiderer. You know, some women, the creating of patterns, some women, the sewing of the blouses. I was one of the ones who embroidered the blouses. I used to think it was my therapy. It allowed me to relax, to think about my life and to think what I would like to do in the future if allowed, and so on. So in that sense, it was a way of, it made me feel more resilient, more stable.
Personally, I am not very good with my hands, so I am more intellectual than laborer by hand. But I did things that later they told me that the university parish church organized exhibition with my work, because they were from my university and people recognized me, and so they saw the little things I did. I did weaving, I did work in leather. It's a way of communicating to the exterior in Chile and abroad that this work were made by political prisoners, and that allows you to talk about it, to talk about the dictatorship, talk about what was going on in Chile, was the repression, how the people were disappearing, were executed.
I had time for the first time from my detention to think about what was happening to me. And I realized that I was a witness. For some reason, history is very important to me. And I realized that I had perhaps one day to write about what I was seeing. I would close the door and I would start writing in a small little pieces of paper. And I would hide them inside. I would dismember a cigarette, and I would put it inside, and then put some tobacco in, and topping with some tobacco. And I passing this to my mother during the visit. When I left prison, I asked a guy from the International Red Cross to take all these pieces of paper out of the country in a diplomatic valise. And they were torturing children, mother. They were stretching their bones, mother, and giving them electric shocks, mother, hour upon hour, mother. interminably aged, then ages again, mother. And their shrieks were all round me, mother. And to black guest black, to demented were, mother. Whittle giddy with grief. And I cried as I have never cried before, mother. I cried in a frenzy, mother, desperate to my last fiber, mother. And the children screamed in more and more anguish, mother. And I cry, mother, and I will never cry again, as long as I live.
That experience that we live in the concentration camp is something that has marked my life. And many of the compañeras I met there I still see today here in Chile. And there is a tremendous bond.
It's very nice, you know, to remember, you know, what we were able to do in those circumstances, you know. And most of the objects have a strong meaning in that sense. And also they have a very strong political meaning, you know.
It's a passage to communicate a message with something physical that an object can say what the person who did this underwent torture, survived, was witness of our comrade disappearing.
It was our way of showing that we had not been defeated, and our way of, I don't know, it was our only weapon that we had to show that we had survived. And the way we probably will continue what we were thinking.
But they are very intimate, because people, if they take something made of a little piece of wood or leather or something, it has no value if you're going to sell it. But it has an enormous value for whoever made it and who received it.
Some of our children are becoming interested, you know, and showing more. I wouldn't say commitment, but showing more an interest about how can we, you know, preserve them, how can we keep them.
I feel quite proud of what I've achieved in my life. I even feel very proud that I did knit that cardigan. It was a tremendous achievement. I feel very honoured as well of having been given a chance to survive with my cardigan. We're going to have more holes by the time I die and all that, but hopefully my daughters will keep it and they will show it to the grandchildren and say, you know, this is what your grandma did one day when she was in prison. And she was very proud of it.
As far as I know, this is one of the largest collections of objects made during the dictatorship in concentration camps. Not only shows the huge trust that the creator has put on us to lend the object, but also how 45 years now since the coup d'etat, this issue is still arising quite a large interest. I have kept my blouses. They accompany me to exile. And whenever I see the blouses, I remember a situation so hard like that and show that I can survive, so anyone else can survive a horrendous situation and keep on living.
Thank you. have two screens in our new lecture theatres, but we don't have lights that turn on, so I'm sorry for the glaring lights. So, following on from the panel, from the film screening, let me introduce our speakers. On my far right is Hernando Fernández Canque. And then Sara de Witt, Ana María Pelusa, and then Sergio Vázquez next to me here. We were thinking about how the best way to run this discussion would be, and I think the way we thought about doing it was that I'm going to ask four broad questions to get us thinking and about some of the about the past and the present, and I'm going to ask each of our panelists to respond to those questions in turn, and then we're going to be opening up for questions and comments from all of you. So the first question that I thought that we might start off with is, the documentary focuses mostly on what it was like to live and resist within the concentration camps, but I wondered if we could rewind a little bit. Can you tell us a bit about what it was like to live under dictatorial rule before you were detained? So what it was like in the immediate period after the coup of the 11th of September 1973. I don't know if anybody wants to volunteer to go first. We could... Ana Maria, yes, please. Yeah.
Somebody have to start.
Yeah, fantastic.
Well,
great.
You can hear me, all of you, can't you? Because my voice is loud enough.
Yeah.
No, I don't need that. Anyway, first of all, because I come from a shanty town, I come from a working class family. I was living in a shanty town, of course, and fighting during the Allende's government for the process that was taking place, that was absolutely fantastic for all of us in the shanty town, for the working class people. You will never believe how it was, how invigorating that process was. So that was where they happened before the military coup, and I was very much involved in a political organization called the Movement of Revolutionary Left, the MIR. And I was a leading of the shantytown dwellers. So that is where I was when the military coup took place. When the military coup took place, of course, the first thing that we did was to try to reorganize, to reconnect with all our comrades in the different areas where we were all working, which was very difficult, by the way, because every shanty town, every place was being surrounded by the army, and houses were searched, and so it was difficult. So to organize resistance, it took a lot of courage at the time. And I remember one time that we are in a room without the light because we didn't dare to put the light on, to switch the light on. And then we started hearing all the helicopters over our head, and we knew that we have to escape from there. So as we were in a shantytown house, we were just jumping from one garden to another. When I talk about garden, don't imagine an English garden. Huh? Just imagine a shantytown where you have a shack or a little hut, and then there's this area that you call a garden, and there perhaps there will be a fence that you have to try to jump to the other side or to crawl to the other side and trying to escape and move to the next road, and in that way trying to disappear. So that was how difficult to be organized in any kind of resistance was at the time. Then, of course, as I say, being from a shanty town, I was very soon after arrested. And more or less, that was the end of my participation in any kind of organized resistance as such, because I was taken to a torture center, and the rest is history.
Thank you very much. Would you like to start, Fernando?
Okay. My situation was slightly not different, but in my case, I was really involved in a lot of activity before the coup. I was a member of the Socialist Party, also member of an organization which have to do with the distribution of food, alternative to the commercial things that the government created. But 10 days before the coup, my mother got ill in the north of Chile, and I went to see her. And that is in Arica, which is far away from Santiago, about more than 1,000 miles from Santiago. So with my mother, I went to her town, which is up in the Andes, an Aymara, a small village of about 60 families, no more than 150 people there. So when the coup happened, I was there, and in a way, I was lucky because I wasn't targeted, because all my political activity have been done in Santiago. But even in that small village, the repression was felt immediately. By 10 o'clock in the morning of the 11th of September, we knew that the coup happened, and immediately the police took control of the city. And immediately start making clear that they were in control of everything. And immediately they start committing abuses against human rights, so everybody could see it in the town. Then we went to Arica. Eventually I could go to Arica after a week. And same situation in Arica, a bigger city, but the same situation. As Pelusa mentioned, it was very difficult to do anything because the army took control of all the sector of the city. Eventually, I went to Santiago, and I tried to reconnect with my party and all the things, which was impossible because the whole group, which as I was involved in, it was disbanded. People had been either left the country, or some had been arrested, or people went underground. So I didn't have much connection to do political activity. Then I have to organize my life differently. I was an assistant lecturer of a university in Chile, the University of Chile, so I decided to concentrate in the academic work. And I took more hours. I even enrolled in another full-time degree to have a clear sort of page of my life, everything regulated and all formally, because that allowed me to have two lives. I could have a normal life where I could present myself with all the documentation and at the same time have a clandestine work. Eventually, I met some people from other political party. We organized a small group, then meet other people. Each time I met somebody who gave me some sort of trust, we organized some group of resistance. I ended up participating in two groups, a small group and one big network, apart from individual of my political party, the Socialist Party. In that sense, the situation was very difficult because you have to stick to the role of the two life and don't mix them. When I arrived to Santiago, I have to move totally from my area because everybody knows and knew me in that area. I have to change even physically. Shaving my mustache, cutting my hair, changing my clothes, everything. So the problem is that it is very difficult to have a life which has academic one sort of thing and the other one which is clandestine. In terms of the clandestine work, we could do whatever was possible, which was little. We have to get very rudimentary sort of way of producing some flyers, which were in many cases handwritten, no large quantity, we couldn't do it, and we organized to distribute those flyers, not pass it to the people, but going to sort of public places and leave it there. And it was a minimal work of each in the group not take more than 3 or 5 sin and leave it there. Another part of the underground world was a distribute document. We did get in contact with an organization of the Central Committee of different parties, the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, MRI, so there were some documents circulated. So our role was to get copy of that, read the scene, and take it to another comrade in the group. That was very difficult and dangerous, because if they caught you with that scene, that was you. So in general, I think it was really very difficult situation, because you can imagine the repression, going out in the street, every corner you have a post with people with machine guns and all those things. From time to time, mobile group arrive to different centers, take everybody into detention, checking all the ID, and then keep it there for 4 hours and leaving there. And that was happening in buses, in everything. So everything was very difficult in terms of resistance. But obviously, it was necessary. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sara, do you want to go?
Okay, yeah. I will start by saying that, you know, during the previous to the coup, you want to make a quick summary, you know. The first year of the Popular Union was very interesting, and there was a lot of support from everywhere. I can remember that, you know, that was the year that I entered university, in Santa Maria University in Valparaíso. And spontaneously, people, you know, went and voted for Allende. And I was one of the people who get together with a student and say, okay, what are we going to do now? I was 17 years old at that time. I said, what are we going to do? Oh, okay, let's talk. This was completely independent of any political party. Although that year, the Federation of the Santa Maria Student Union had been won by the left, first time for many, many years. I think it was the first time before it was the Christian Democrat. And that federation was won by the left, and it was the MAPU, which was a split from the Christian Democrat Party. And so, you know, the student life, although it was tough, extremely tough, because, you know, knowledge is a class issue, particularly in those years in Chile. So if you come from a background which is very poor, you don't have too much choices, you know, in terms of competing with the guy who's coming from the, you know, bourgeoisie, and they have a very good education. So yeah, it's quite tough if you're coming from that background. So you have to fight for staying in the university. But even though, under those circumstances, the good thing that it was is that there was already been a strong, you know, reform from the university student, which started in 1967 and prolonged until, you know, until 1973. So in there, you met a very good you know, environment, and the people talk, and then we went and voted for Allende. It was an independent group, and we supported Allende. And that year, as I said before, it was very important for the popular unity, because at that time, you know, most of the important nationalizations, land reform, unemployment reduction, and you know, a lot of measures which were promised by the popular union came to the right place, and the people were very happy. And the first election that they did in 1970, all the, you know, election council, like they call it here, it was won by about 51%. It was amazing. Allende got empowered by, you know, 33% of the vote. So it was a big jump at that time. And this was because of the enthusiasm of the Chilean people to go up to there. But the second year was more difficult, because by that time, you know, the ruling class, they knew more or less what is going to happen. And they start to reorganize, and they start to unify, you know. So the National Party, which was the right wing, it unified with the Christian Democrat, and then they start to put a lot of problem during 1972. And also, you know, the gremios, you know, the the people who are from the
union,
but it's not the professional union, the union which is coming from the right, right? Yeah. So like a medical association and that kind of thing, they start to act together, right? And there was a big strike, which is a boss strike. It's a strike from the bosses actually, from the, which paralyzed the country, right? And I think by 1972 is when the people, for the first time, they can see, okay, this is going to be a serious confrontation further in the future, and they reorganize in a pretty strong way, very strong way. And I guess that was the moment when the most of the trade unions start to, you know, link together in different small but different industrial belt, that they call it, cordones industriales. So it appeared about that time, right? So that was more or less the second year where the confrontation was more strong. And then it came the last year, of course, where the right wing half nearly a terrorist organization, which was called Patria y Libertad, right? And this was, definitely going for the overthrowing of Allende, okay? So by that time, I already joined the MIR, which have a connection because, as I said before, the student reform was very strong movement, okay? And what one of the wonderful things that the student did at that time, and that they took connection with different parts of the society. Okay, so the student reform wanted three major things: democratization of the university. Okay, they wanted to put the university at the service of the people, and democratization, service of the people, were the two major points that they wanted to cover. And of course, they wanted to modernize the university, and in doing so. Student Federation was able at that time in the latest year, 71, to have participation directly in the Senate of the university, and at the same time they had connection with shantytown people, which will live on the outskirts of in the hills of Valparaíso and Viña del Mar, and they also have connection with the industrial belt. So it was, at that time, you were less as a full-time student, more a political activities. So you were going to all those places, and this was part of the federation, it was a student federation where they were linked to those sectors. So it was a very important moment and a very active situation, but very confrontational. So 1973, I would say, by 10 of September 1973, in Valparaíso, we have the Catholic University, which had been taken over by the right-wing Patria Libertad and the terrorist guy. They took over the university, and they say, we are not going to move from here until Allende goes, right? So that was the situation in Valparaíso. Unfortunately, during the Popular Unity government, a law was passed, of course, by the right-wing, which it was the control, armed control. The law of armed control that was passed by Carmona and all this guy on those days, and that law allowed all the military to intervene anywhere on the excuse that they are looking for arms, okay, and that was the excuse. And at the same time, there was a strong movement within the parties where they wanted to, say to the army forces, okay, you should be on the side of the people. And that happened in Valparaíso, where the Navy, a section of the Navy, was in favor of Allende. And they were arrested. August 1973, they were arrested, okay? And there was about 23 people within the Navy who were arrested and tortured on those days, okay? And we received the message as a student, right? And on the other hand, you have all the lorry strike, which has put all the lorries which were circulating on that in the port. Valparaíso is a port, but Valparaíso and Viña is a port. And they have all this lorry in the field of the Navy. So it's about 150 lorries which have been stationed there on the field of the Navy. So see
on those moments how confrontational was the situation, right? So 10th of September came, and the party had a meeting, my section, they had a meeting in the university, and then that was in the night, we left from the university, and then the next day, the next night, 3 o'clock in the morning, the military coup came to Valparaiso. And then they started in Valparaiso because the Navy have good connection with UNITAS. UNITAS was coming from the United States to make a kind of army operation on that area. So I escaped just by luck. So that was, you know, 11th of September 1933. By luck, because I was living in a hall of residence very near the university. It's about, you know, 500 meters from there. And in the morning, we wake up with military, bands on the radio and say something's going wrong here. What's going on? In the previous meeting, we have discussed that it was possible a military coup, but nobody knew that it was so possible it was the next morning. And then I went to the university, and the Navy had taken control absolutely of the university. In fact, it was created like a small concentration camp for about a week there. And you, people who have been working on the human rights area, Michael Woodward, who was a priest who used to go to the university, he was captured in that area, and he was put in prison straight and sent to the Esmeralda. So from that moment on, we tried to get connection, it was impossible. There was no, you know, everything was absolutely controlled. And so we have, during the first week, I am extending too much.
No, well, I mean, I think what's so interesting is how we can't look at this just in terms of 11th of September.
Exactly,
or in terms of resistance in terms of the 11th of September. We have to look at the longer process to understand the organisation, the contact with society. Let me move on to Sara, and then we'll come back, because I think that we can talk about the similarities and differences. Thank you so much. Sara?
Let me know if I talk too much. Now, about the period after the coup, I would say that it was very challenging from beginning to end. I managed to survive around 20 months only. But it was challenging from the personal point of view, as a woman, as a member of a political party. Now, on the 11th of September, the day of the coup, I was rushing to university because I had to take a very important test. And I went there, and people were running everywhere, and they told me, oh, there is a coup. So at that moment, I knew what I had to do, and I had to go to a meeting. I had to go and meet people because we were supposed to resist. We were going to fight back the coup. So off I went. I passed in front of the presidential palace, which was on fire, and some airplanes. But in spite of that, I thought I had to go because I could revert the situation with my comrades. So I met whoever I had to meet, and we went with another comrade, another woman. We went to a neighborhood where I used to work politically. We stayed there from probably 3 days, and we were waiting. We were in contact with the political party, with my political party, waiting what will happen, what we were going to do. Now, we waited and waited, telephone calls, but nothing was happening. And there was a big rumor that one of the generals, Pratt, was marching from the south of Chile to Santiago, and the situation could be reverted because he had so many number of troops and so on. Now, we didn't know whether it was true or not, but we waited. And what happened that there was a group of teenagers around 14, 16 years old that came to talk to us, to my friend and me, and they said, listen, we have made something like, I don't remember the number, I don't want to lie, but perhaps 20 or 30 Molotov cocktails. We are ready to go and fight. With my friend, we froze. We said to them, no, we cannot do it. We have to wait. They were children. They were children, but they wanted to fight. We were in conversation with people from other political tendencies. In the neighborhood, the majority of the people were families who work in the industries around where they live. And after the second day, we realized that nothing was going to happen. We made the young men, you know, to get rid of those bottles. And after that, we went. But I just wanted to tell you that incident, because I don't know how many people live in the neighborhood. I knew at the time. But everybody there was prepared to fight back, even the children. And people, I didn't live there, but people show quite a lot of support. They were very supportive. They didn't know who I was. And they fed us and so on. Well, I left, I went home. I was living in a place near the National Stadium, Villa Olímpica. I was living in a council flat there. And when I arrived, my mom, like many of the other neighbors, had taken nearly all my books and burned them. Because the army was going into the house, she burned even my university books, my collection of Marxists, everything disappeared. It was very hard at that time, because where I was living, I could see the army burning books. You just pass in front of them and burning books in the corners. I saw many times people being taken out, neighbors being taken out from where they live, you know, it mainly men, you know, walking like that. And you were terrified in the street. I would say the period was very frightening. Something else that happened in the area where I live. I'm saying the area where I live, but I imagine that was being replicated in other places. Several times, three or four times, we have helicopters shooting to people in the flat. And it was very frightening. You had to throw yourself to the floor and wait for the helicopter to go. And when you have small children, my sister in a school, you know, it was terrifying. Now, it had a big impact. All that had an impact to you as an individual, as a student. The university was closed. They never gave me back my grant. You know, I didn't know whether I would be back to the university. What are you going to do? Where are you going to get the money to survive? As a woman, you felt very threatened. At that time, the army, God knows what idea they have about women, but if you were in the street with trousers, they will cut your trousers at the knee level. And you knew that you had to avoid them, and you were at risk. On the 11th of September, many women went to places, you know, to fight back. And for example, they went to industries. And what I know, because some of the women who were there, the army started going to all the industries in that area, and they raped women. So you knew that, and you knew that you have to avoid them. You have to avoid the army as much as you could. Now, when I start after the coup trying to connect with people. Many of the people that were my comrades, they used to work in factory, because at the time, you know, I saw that where I wanted to do my political work was with people working in factories, because I have read Marx, Lenin, and so on, and I thought that was the main contradiction, and I had to work there. Many of those people, when I went back, they had been taken by the army, and they were no more. So anyway, I persisted, and my work until I was detained was mainly getting support in terms of money, places where people could hide, and passing information. We didn't have social media, we didn't have internet, hence people didn't know what was going on. And so I was engaged with our people, doing microfilms about information and, you know, putting them in boxes of, I don't know, sugar or whatever, and smuggling them and distributing among people. And that is basically, you know, what I was doing. But when I was saying, I want to say something about more the individual level, because we always, you know, concentrate and think that is quite important about the political thing, about the impact that brought on people. Well, I would say about my case personally. I developed an stomach ulcer because I felt persecuted, and it was true that I was being persecuted. And I also, you know, I have to go and hide myself in houses, in what it was called safe houses. And when you are on the run with no money, it's really very stressful. And I developed something called Meniere vertigo. That basically, you something go loose in your ears and you fall, you know. So, and I think that probably wasn't the stress, you know. It depends very, very much how you endure and how you deal with the stress. But I don't think that it was my personal only situation, because people usually don't talk about that, because I wanted myself to be very strong. And many of my friends, for example, they were saying to me, people that have worked with for years, I'm off, I'm going to Europe, I'm going here, I'm going there, and some people going into the embassy, and you cannot blame them, because it was really frightening. But you know, I had at the time to make a decision, whether it was a right or wrong decision, you don't know, and perhaps there is not right or wrong, you do what you need to do. But it was very frightening. I remember that probably 2 weeks after the coup, I looked myself at the mirror, and when I saw, I was shocked, because the color of my skin was gray, and I remember that it was the color of the elephants. And I thought, my God, you know, that is the color of the elephant. And that was the stress. Now, and when I said it was challenging, because I was all the time thinking about, well, what do I do? Do I carry on? My mom was all the time, leave the country, in spite that I never told her that I was involved in a political party. But it was very stressful, because you have to be making decisions, political decisions, personal decisions. Do I go? Do I stay? What do I do? That is all what I wanted to say about after the coup.
Thank you. I don't want to stop any of you, because I think all of us kind of want to continue hearing what it was like. What I want to do is, I'm going to join the next questions I had together and to bring us to the present. I think we might go slightly over 8 o'clock, but I'm keen for people to have an opportunity to speak. So if we go as briefly as possible, I hate being a chair, but that's what I'm going to ask you to do. The second question I want to ask, which is about thinking about the present and the striking, particularly the striking levels of violence that has been used by the Piñera government, the military, the carabineros in response to the recent protests. What have you seen as being the main similarities and differences in the situation during the dictatorship and now? And in particular, I'm interested in kind of repertoires of resistance. What have been the ways in which people have kind of organized today, and or particularly how they may have used art or culture to organize? What are the similarities and differences between now and then? Pelusa, do you want to start us off?
Well, I started before. I should.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Well,
because I tend to be brief. Yeah.
If you move,
and I hope so.
Can you just for the recording mainly? Yeah. Thank you.
First of all, term of resistance then. Remember, we were resisting a dictatorship where the army and the police was there, when secret police was everywhere. Yeah. Now, what we are, the people, the movement today is a social movement that is fighting a dictocracia. I call it dictocracia because it's a dictator democratically elected, so it's a dictocracy, yeah? And the people hasn't got the political party. The people that are in the street don't follow a political party as such. They are rejecting the political parties. In our time, we belong to different political parties, and we were doing what our party was telling us to do, trying to convey to the people, giving them guidance of how to conduct the resistance, what to do, what our aim was to. But at the moment, we have a movement in the street that is very, they do whatever they want, yeah? They are there, but they are fighting. What is important is that they are there, they are fighting, and they are losing their eyes. There are more than 3,000 that are political prisoners at the moment. There are almost 400 people that have lost one eye. You mentioned it earlier on. Two people that have completely been blinded, people that have been raped, men and women. When I say rape, there's two cases that are sticking in my mind constantly, and one is a 17-year-old guy that, because of his surname, I associated to a family that lost five relatives during the dictatorship, and this boy was arrested during the protest, and 5 days later, he was released, and well, was thrown in the street, and he started shouting for help, and he said, "I have been tortured and raped." When they examined him, it was true. Then the other case was a student, a four-year doctor of medicine, that was also arrested and tortured. And all the time, this man that have studied 4 years to be a doctor, that was only there trying to help somebody that needed medical aid, was raped, and they forced him to shout, "I am gay, I am gay." And I say, for God's sake, if he was gay, so what? Does it give them the right to rape him? No. But those are the cases that stick in my mind. And when you say, what is the similarity between then and now, then they could do whatever they want with us. Rape us, torture us, make us disappear. Today, there's a difference. Today, everybody got the mobile phone. Everybody's recording, everybody's shouting when somebody gets arrested. You name, tell me your name. So the information is out in the open. So there's a difference, but that doesn't mean that the repression is different. It doesn't mean that, because they have secret torture places, they have secret detention centers, and the police can do whatever they want, and the justice system is allowing them to do it, and the Senate and the deputy, also the MPs and the senators, are allowing them to do whatever, because they are accepting and passing laws that the dictatorial government is asking them to pass against the people that are protesting. So they are criminalizing the protest. They are criminalizing the people that are in jail at the moment. So Amnesty International is not taking their cases, because they have been accused of, oh, he was going to throw a Molotov. No, he was going to kill a policeman. No, he was assaulting this or whatever. So Amnesty is not taking their cases. And we are begging people to do something about those almost 3,000 people that are in jail that need the support of international support to get them out, and also the condemnation of the Piñera government. So that is the difference. During the dictatorship, everybody knew that it had the support of the USA, and it had the support, the complicit support of all the democratic governments around the world. Yeah? And now we have a government that is accepted by everybody. And in the United Nations, we have a woman that used to be a president in our country and is in charge of the Human Rights Department and is not lifting a bloody finger to condemn what is happening in Chile. Not the bloody finger. So that is the difference. We have people that should be doing something to condemn that, and they are not doing anything. And we have people in the street that are risking their life to fighting for their basic human rights. It wasn't a demonstration because of they increased 5 pence in the transport. No, or 30 pence. It was 30 or 40 years of repression. That is what is causing the situation that is taking place today in Chile. And I know, because my people come from a shanty town, my people come from the working class, and that is what is going on. Yeah. So that is the difference. That is the difference. One was a dictatorship, one is a dictocracy. That is the difference.
Thank you very much, Pelusa.
Okay. I agree with what Pelusa is saying. During the military dictatorship, The military have full control of everything. They control everything, every single thing. An example, my university, the day after open, they put somebody there in charge of everything. He has never been in the university, but he was in charge of all the university. You couldn't do anything. And in terms of repression, the repression was massive. And they have a really sinister intention. It was made visible. People were beaten in the street. People were killed. The bodies were joined to the people left in the street so everybody could see, because the intention was to the terror. The idea was that people would be afraid to rebel. The majority of the people were always in favor of the popular movement. They were in favor of the Allende government. And each election of the three years of Allende, the vote in favor of that government was increasing. So the army took that action, brutality, to avoid the people taking arms or to do protest or masses. So for the repression during the junta was massive, was indiscriminate, people were made sample and all the stuff. Now, of course, there is a repression under Piñera, as indicated by all the report and Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the UN. But it's slightly different in terms of the government intention. The repression that happens now is sort of hidden. The government denied the detention. And sometimes they want to justify the repression. They say, oh, people are whatever doing something that need to be punished. That's the difference. It's not massive, it's limited in number, but it's done in such a way that people are not made accountable. If I can find any similarity in both cases, is that in both cases where the rebellion and all the stuff was to change the society for a better society. To me, that's the only similarity that I can find. In terms of difference as well, during the junta, all the resistance was led by the political parties. At the moment, all the resistance is led by the social movement, which is a big difference. And we will see what happened in the future, what's happened. It is, we are living in a very dangerous situation, because on one hand, the social movement have created an explosion which might lead to change the constitution, which might lead to a better society. But on the other hand, the right-wingers are active again. They are again showing signs of what they did during Allende, destroying monument of Allende, Victor Jara, again Patria y Libertad, a paramilitary group that existed in the 70s, now is active. So in a way, it's a very difficult situation, and hopefully we will get good result, but we don't know.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I remember a poet in Chile which wrote something very interesting. Of course, it was a poem, but what he wrote, that Chile is a big concentration camp. And that big concentration camp is upside down. So everybody who's outside the concentration camp, they suffer. They don't have education easier. They have a lot of problem with getting day-to-day life. And it's very difficult life for them. And inside, there is the people who, according to this poet, they say, they fly in quilts with dead red on, and goose
feather, so they are flying up and down. And that is the real situation in Chile. It's a big upside-down concentration camp where the majority of the people, you know, and because the dictatorship created, refound our society completely and create a neoliberal system where the majority is excluded, absolutely excluded, right? And that's the fundamental thing of this system, is that you cannot touch anything which is, you know, somebody attempt to go against the private property, you cannot do anything. Nothing can be done outside that. So the state is a subsidiary state where they have to ask for this and that to pass some law, and they cannot pass the law. And this, everybody is playing his game here. From the political party, which are on the extreme, the UDI, UDI, which they created the constitution, yeah, Guzmán, who was created the constitution, to the Frente Amplio, which today vote in favor of the criminalization of the protest. So how the people in Chile can see that? We say, yes, it's a mass movement. Of course it's a mass movement. There is no connection between the old political party that we used to have in the oldest time with the people. They abandon completely the people. They cannot have a connection with them, right? So that situation is completely out. And I was lucky that we traveled to Chile on the 12th of October. And so we stayed during this rebellion, this popular rebellion. We were really lucky to see how the people explode. We arrived on the 12th, and we were a little bit, asking what the hell is going on here. Everybody's calling, evade, evade, what happened here? And so it was a student, it was not the university student, to note, you know, which is very important. It was the secondary student who rebelled against the 30 pesos, which was an increase on the fare of the metro, on the underground. And they rebelled by jumping on the barrier. And then what the government say, okay, you know, you don't have to worry about this because, you know, if you want to get cheaper ticket, you have to get up early. You know, that's all. You have to get up 2 o'clock in the morning and then take the train and you're right there. So the ruling classes are so displeasant and indifferent to the plight of the people that it was going to happen something very important. And then the 18 came and it was really amazing. It was really amazing. People went to the streets, in numbers that I never expected. Not even at the time of the popular unity, I saw this in the small town, people on the street, I was about one and a half kilometers in a small town where the people were shouting and banging their pots. It was really incredible. And they jumped and they were happy, And during the night, you know, in Chile, what happened is that you have the pharmacy. They collude to increase the price of the medicine. So when I was there and my wife was there, and we had to buy one simple, inhaler, it cost £70. £70, which is the equivalent as to 70,000 pesos in Chile. And the salary minimum is 200,000 pesos. So, what can you do with that? Right, and they collude. That's the collusion of the pharmacy. And the supermarket, they collude. There is a collusion because they wanted to increase the value of the chickens. The chickens are very expensive, of the comfort, very expensive. So they collude, right? And the bank also collude, okay? So the night from the 18th to 19th, all the bank, all the pharmacies, and all the supermarket were completely destroyed, burned. So that was the answer from the people. They burned all this, and it was directed to all this, particular area. So when I went to Quilpue, which is very near Valparaíso, by the way, the time when I stayed there during the resistance. So I went there because my family is there. My wife's family is there, not my family. I come from the north. So we went there,
And we really, you know, were impressed because they were burned in the town, in Middletown, were completely burned. But the next day, the people went during the day and they protest in a peaceful way. Yeah? And I went to the different protests there, and it was very peaceful. And the people were chanting, and they were, you know, doing... We passed through a school, which was a particular school, and we took a lot of photos from them. And the kids, which were 4-year-old, 6 to 10-year-old, they do a lot of drawing, right? I took a picture of all the drawing, a lot of drawing, and saying, Chile woke up, you know? They say, you know, where is our health? My grandfather is dying. All that kind of thing in picture of the kids. That happened in that little town. So, I mean, if you take the similarity, yes, the mass movement is not controlled by the political party because there is no connection with them. They are lost. They lost the connection. There is no connection with them. There is a systematic and repression. Yes, there is a systematic repression. And it's directly against the people who are doing the protest. Okay, it's a very bad repression, and you know, from all the institutions of human rights, they are, you know, saying exactly what's going on, and that's one of the difference. When the military coup came in 1973, the press, international press, was very favorable to agenda, and they, you know, they say everything. But now the press is controlling Chile; they say very little. Also, is controlling internationally. So. Very rarely you see a report what's going on in Chile. Very, very difficult. So that's something very, you know, different today and similar in terms of the repression which is going on here. The good difference, of course, is that now we have the social media. So everybody is informed through the social media. Right.
So it's a big difference from Hernando's leaflets in a park. Exactly. With the handwritten notes that you have to put.
Exactly. Whatever. Yes, yes. So
let me move to Sara. I'm sorry, and then I'm conscious that we're going to go on past 8 o'clock. We have to, because we have to get some questions. But and we'll go to about 20 past. But Sara.
Okay, I will try to be brief. I think that how I see it myself, I think that one of the issues is about what is a political power, people's power. And for that, what I mean, what we are seeing now in Chile is that the enormous amount of people that go out to the street and they said, and they have stated, we want a new constitution, and we are going to write it. Basically, they are saying, we have got the power, we are going to do it. In contraposition, when I was living in Chile, for me, the power was being represented by Salvador Allende in his presidential palace and with the MPs and so on. I never felt that I had much power, although I was trying to organize a local power. But I think that that is the main difference. People have said, we have got the power. They have refused to obey to the president, all the legislation. They are cleaning their hands with that. I think that that is something quite important. And the other issue important is the social movement. We have got the student, we have got the women's movement. Women have been, well, from all their life, but especially after the coup, they have been a major, major engine in all of this. They have got a very important movement, and they are calling for a general strike on the 8th of March. And probably you will have seen that. The thesis, you know, what they have been doing. So it's quite important, the women's movement. Now, the other issue that I think that is happening is basically the sum of what is going on. During my time, we had the coup d'etat. Then we have neoliberalism and so on. And it's about things growing. Because, for example, in Chile now, you see that in the demonstration that I was amazed to see. For example, the number of flags from the Mapuche people. Yeah. The Mapuche people is a very, very long problem for many centuries. And when you think about it, it's still boiling there. Yeah. And what people are doing, they are taking, you know, the Mapuche's flags. People are complaining. They are going to the street and saying, we don't want this neoliberal system anymore. I think that is all.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
before I go to the question, I asked you all to think of a gift or a gift you would give to a new generation, not necessarily as an instruction in terms of what to do, but a gift in terms of what lived experience might have taught you. And I'm going to ask you, actually, if you could think of one or two words, what gift would that be? If it was a kind of a, okay, I lived this experience and you're now living a kind of similar but different experience, is there a word that would sum up the gift you would?
I am always telling all the young people, don't trust anybody. Okay. Don't trust your shadow. Don't trust your shadow. Don't trust your left hand or your right hand. Don't tell them what you are doing. Do things, but don't trust anybody, because that's the only way that you will survive and the resistance will survive. You have to keep everything.
Be alert.
Be alert. Don't trust your shadow. Okay. It will follow you.
All right, thank you. Hernando.
I think resistance is a must. We have to do it. Obviously, you have to be careful, but be careful in such a way that that doesn't stop you from resist. We do want a better society, and I think history is in our sort of side, and sort of optimistic that the whole human race is changing for the good. To the centuries or millennium, we have been changing different systems, different, even going from feudal system to capitalist system, but that was an advance. Now capitalist system is obsolete, the neoliberal is obsolete. We need to change it, that would be the, and do it.
Okay, thank you. Sergio, do you have a word or two of advice for the next, or? Sorry,
yeah.
Gift. I said not advice, gift.
I think, you know, I am humble in that. I have to see, I saw what they are doing, so I'm very happy with that. I cannot, you know, it's very difficult for me to what we did during the agendas and after that during the resistance time, to 5 years in resistance. It's very difficult to translate exactly, so I'm learning from them.
Okay.
It's a new experience for me, and I'm very happy for that. Okay. The only thing that we say is that after coming here to, you know, to UK, the Chilean exile did a very good job in terms of organization, and we went everywhere, from the top to the bottom, everywhere. And I would like to see to the young generation here in UK, the people who are here, which they could repeat that experience,
Okay. Because
they need that to support the people in Chile. Okay, that experience, which you know most of the people did here, is good to be passed, learn, and then you know, make the connection with our country there. So that's what I would like to say.
Thank you, yeah. Sara.
I think that what I would say that I'm really very happy about is the way that especially young people and Chileans are working in Chile. That is mainly working as a social movement. Now, I think that the importance of that is that make people to unite with each other. I'm not criticizing the political parties, but in my generation, we were in a political party and you have your little compartment, your little offices. But what is showing people in Chile is that they are united, and that is so important. And they are adding different situations, different issues like the environment, that is so important. They are adding the issue of the women, the issue of the Mapuche, and working very much in community, and that hasn't got the price. I just hope that they will continue.